Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Mary Beth Pfeiffer, projects writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal. Mary Beth has been working on a series for the paper called Killers at Pain, which focuses on the prescription drug and heroin epidemic. Welcome, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. What a delight to have you here. You know, you've always been a hero to all of us, and I just want to know how you got into the game.
By the game, I take it you mean...
Journalism.
Into journalism. Okay. That goes back quite a ways. We're talking the late 1970s.
You're still a very young woman.
Oh, thank you so much. And basically, I had sort of a talent for writing. And I remember in the fourth grade getting up in front of the assembly and reading the poem of the week to the entire school.
You wrote the poem?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
But I also had this sense, and I told my first editor in my first interview, that I wanted to change the world. And in some small way, journalism really does allow you to participate, at least in that process of making things better.
Well, we don't see many like you, to be fair. We don't see people who go out and really rake the coals and figure out what could be better. We see a lot of sort of humdrum reporting, but we don't see a lot of digging. What's that all about?
I might agree with that, but on the other hand, it costs a lot of money to have somebody
sure.
like me on staff and to give me the time that's necessary to really dig into a topic. I might spend a month, sometimes 2 months, on a single story. And it's to the credit of my newspaper that they devote the resources that are necessary.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, let's go to your latest pieces and tell us why you chose to talk about the epidemic. Obviously, it is an epidemic. And when I had an operation, recently a back operation, they gave me OxyContin, which I, of course, never used because I'm scared to death of it, and put it in a drawer. And my wife came across it the other day and said, well, what's this OxyContin doing here? I said, well, we have to bring it over to the police station, drop it in the receptacle there, because people steal for it. They rob for it. Now we're hearing it's so hard to get that it's created an uptick in the heroin use of heroin, which is far easier to get and far cheaper for a sort of a different high. And so how did you get into it and what have you found?
Well, all those things you just said are true. And anybody with additional or extra supplies of prescription painkillers in their homes that they're not using should dispose of them properly. Take them to a police station or a certified disposal spot. Because yes, they are getting out onto the black market. Kids are stealing them from medicine chests. They are being abused and they are leading to serious, serious problems.
And what do they do?
In our society.
In other words, what is somebody who takes this stuff going to feel?
Well, you do get high from them, but the way this really happened goes back to 1996, and that was when OxyContin came onto the market, and it came onto the market with the advisory that it really wasn't a danger for addiction. The FDA actually approved the label on OxyContin to say that addiction as a result of this drug would be, quote unquote, very rare. It was based on a study of burn victims who were treated in the short term, who only showed a 1% addiction rate. Well, that turned out not to be true and not to be reliable. But in the intervening time between the introduction of OxyContin and this terrible epidemic that we're experiencing now, there was a huge marketing campaign for OxyContin.
You mean on public on public facilities like...
No, the pharmaceutical industry
yes.
sold this very heavily. So much so that OxyContin went from $48 million in sales in 1996 to $1.1 billion by 2001.
Whoa.
Huge, huge increase. And they did this by holding, for example, 40 conferences around the country, all expense paid, for doctors, for pharmacists, in which they schooled them in OxyContin, sold the idea that this was not addictive and trained them to be speakers to other doctors.
Well, some people saw that as a sort of a bribe, that they would pay them, quote, to give speeches. I know a lot of doctors who give speeches. And really what's being done here, a lot of people think, is getting them to give speeches so they can get some money. They give them money for that, and therefore they then become proselytizers for the drug.
Well, there are studies that show that doctors are not influenced by these sorts of gambits and gigs. Yeah, I would say that we can raise questions as to whether, in fact, they are influenced and unduly influenced. But the other things they did as part of this marketing campaign, it was the first time in the history of pharmaceuticals that a controlled substance was sold in this way. They gave out stuffed animals that said OxyContin. They gave out fishing hats, OxyContin. They gave out CDs that had music on them, swing along with OxyContin. 34,000 coupons were distributed for free 7 to 30 day supplies of OxyContin. Well, needless to say, the drug caught on, and the figures show how successful this marketing campaign was. That also led to other kinds of drugs like this to enter the market and to see very big, you know, significant hikes in their sales. But ultimately, we learned the hard way that it was, in fact, an addictive drug, that despite the claims of the maker that the OxyContin was a special formulation that was time release. So it wasn't prone to abuse because you couldn't take it all at once and get this powerful bang. Well, what happened is people learned that they could crush it. They could make a slurry of it.
What was that word you used, a slurry?
Slurry, yeah. They could basically ingest it and get that instant high. They could even inject it or
snort it. It's just that I never heard the word slurry before.
Yeah. Well, it's a mixture of stuff. Yeah. And so it became very much prone to abuse. The other thing, though, it turned out that when you used it for chronic pain, you became dependent on it. Whether you abused it in that way or not, you became dependent on it. And we're also learning now that using it for chronic pain turns out to be not such an effective way to treat pain. You need more and more of it to have an effect, and it makes the user very tired. It makes the user essentially, new studies are showing, just sort of drop out of life because it's very hard to keep going when you're under the influence of this kind of drug. So there are just so many ways in which OxyContin fell down on the job, as did the marketing of OxyContin, in telling us and telling the public that this was not an addictive drug. It was, in fact, addictive, and it hooked many, many people. And
is it hard to get off once you're on?
It's very difficult. It is on par with heroin. It is in the same family of drugs as heroin.
It is?
It has the same effect on the brain. Yes, it is an opioid. It's ultimately derived from, either synthetically or naturally, the poppy seed. And I'd also add that it's really not a debated point that this drug was oversold. The company that introduced it ultimately had to pay $600 million in fines for fraudulent marketing.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what that fraudulent marketing involved?
For knowingly contending that OxyContin was less addictive and less prone to abuse because of this special formulation that they had for the time release of the product.
Does OxyContin have cousins? In other words, other drugs that are sort of like OxyContin?
Yes, there's Vicodin, and I guess Vicodin is the chief contender for a competition with OxyContin. Right now, oxycodone, which is the generic for OxyContin, and hydrocodone, which is what Vicodin is made out of, are the two leading opioid drugs being used in New York State and around the country. One of these stories that I did was an analysis of the sales of all the controlled substances in New York State. I got the top 10 drugs for each of our 62 counties. Well, lo and behold, the top drugs in 60 of those 62 counties was either oxycodone or hydrocodone.
Wow.
And that was last year. And the volumes of product being put out there on the market was really quite surprising. 6.9 million prescriptions in a single year in New York State for those two drugs. Upstate, the rate at which those two drugs were prescribed would allow each adult to have, or 6 in 10 adults to have, a single prescription. That's a lot of drug out there.
Mary Beth Byford, do we have any kind of understanding as to how much was really being used to treat pain, how much was being used, you know, for a high?
I think we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that a great deal of it was diverted for non-medical uses. One of the statistics I came across recently is that 12 million people admitted in 2010 in a national survey to non-medical use of opioids. Namely, I got it from my friend, I wasn't prescribed it, I used it off prescription. So that's a lot of people.
Well, then talk to us about the doctors who are doing the prescribing.
Well, doctors would claim that they were responding to a need out there. And they're right, to an extent. When you go back to the 1970s, we had this sense in the medical community that we couldn't give morphine or related painkillers even to people in end-stage cancer because they might become addicted. There was a great fear of addiction.
For morphine.
For morphine and related.
Could you just stop for a second, little parenthesis here? What's the relationship between OxyContin and morphine?
Morphine is also an opioid. All these drugs are in the same class of drug. They come ultimately from the poppy seed. And back in the 70s, we had morphine. We had methadone back then, which is also used as a painkiller. I'm trying to think of the others. But we had painkillers in that family of drugs, but we did not avail ourselves of them, because there was this great fear of addiction.
You didn't get morphine pills to take home from you after your back operation?
No, not back then.
Yeah.
Well, we have completely gone from one end of the spectrum to the other because there became this awareness in the 80s and 90s that we had to start treating pain a little bit more efficiently. We weren't doing a good job. And people were right. There was a great clamor to treat pain. And in many ways, the OxyContin manufacturers of the world seized that. And they came along at the right time, and that was when we were slowly becoming aware that we were undertreating pain. Even the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals came out around the year 2000 with a scale of pain. We will ask patients what you're feeling on a scale of 1 to 10, and many hospitals were required to ask that so we could gauge your pain and treat your pain. So doctors sort of stepped into this situation in which these prescriptions products were coming along, the awareness was growing, the Joint Commission was saying, ask about pain.
And they were being lectured to by the drug companies about the advantages of OxyContin and Condo.
Exactly. And these painkillers work, too. When you mm-hmm. have short-term pain, they are very effective. I broke my shoulder in February while I was skiing in Vermont. I was taken to an emergency room in Bennington, was treated. I was given OxyContin. I took it. I was only given several pills to take home with me.
Was this before you started work on this?
This was before I started work on this series, but I did know I was going to do this series. So it was an interesting confluence of events. I found the OxyContin helped me a lot. I was in a great deal of pain. And doctors tell me that this is the way this drug should be used for acute short-term pain or perhaps end-of-life pain. But the chronic pain is the question. They're not so sure anymore, or science is not so sure. Researchers aren't.
Define chronic for us.
Chronic would be something that's ongoing and years long.
Mm-hmm.
I have had calls from people with rheumatoid arthritis who tell me they need this drug. I am hampering their ability to get this drug,
mm-hmm.
although this is certainly much bigger than me and started, you know, well before I came on the scene. So chronic, yes, is some long-term condition, maybe some sort of back injury that you sustained at work. But what I'm hearing is that the person who had that back injury and gets onto one of these opioids for the long term is much less likely to go back to work as a result.
What about the police agencies in terms of, you know, the illicit or illegal use of this stuff? What have the police agencies been involved? Are they scared because they're doctors who have prescribed the stuff, or would they rather stay out of it, or are they getting involved?
Well, they're certainly getting involved because they're seeing prescription drugs turn up on the street. They also are getting involved big time because it is leading to this wave of heroin abuse. But I was talking to a long-term 20-year detective last week, and he said to me that this is the most devastating thing he's ever seen, because he responds to these overdose calls and these overdose deaths, and he sees where they're occurring and who is affected and the magnitude of the problem. It's huge. It is a huge public health problem. It is a huge crisis.
Now, the antidote to heroin is now being prescribed for police and other first responders to carry around with them. Is there such a thing for opioids?
There is. It's called Narcan, or naloxone is the generic form. And every first responder, meaning police agencies, ambulance attendants, emergency medical technicians, will be eventually armed with this tool. It's very effective. It's used intranasally, namely up the nose, sometimes intravenously. And I had a doctor recount when he used it in an emergency room. And he said a young man was brought in. Somebody just left him and took off. And he said this young man was on his last breath. And he gave him Narcan, not knowing that that was the problem.
Is that the same stuff used for heroin?
Yes. And he immediately revived.
We're talking with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, projects writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal. Okay, so Mary Beth, let's talk a little bit more about what has happened to this drug. Now, we keep hearing that heroin is now becoming a drug of choice because it's cheaper and because it's getting too hard to get the OxyContin and its cousins. So is that true?
It is getting much more difficult to get prescription painkillers. Well, 16 states now, including New York, have passed prescription monitoring programs, namely laws in which doctors have to check the prescribing history of the patient that they're seeing. So in New York...
How do they know that somebody isn't lying to them? In other words...
Well, that's what was happening for years before this law went into effect.
Right.
You would go to your GP and you'd go to your orthopedist and you'd go to your, you know, ear, nose and throat person, and you'd say, I've got pain here, there and everywhere. And a lot of people did that. They did it for two reasons, because they were abusers or they did it to make money. But now that's much more difficult to do in New York and these other states. And that's because the doctor looks on this database, sees if you've been to here or there for prescription drugs, and says, yes or no, I'm going to give you this prescription or I'm not. And as a result, the prescribing figures have really dropped. In New York, in the last quarter of last year, hydrocodone prescriptions went down by 20%. And hydrocodone was tops in 47 of 62 counties last year.
So interesting, because we don't allow the prescription of heroin. We do OxyContin. But we're able to cut back on the prescriptions by tightening up, which is something we can't do with heroin. Have you thought about that?
Well, I've thought about that in terms of we have an epidemic right now that was created through legal means, by legal drugs. I saw a tweet by a doctor who's very upset about this and has formed a group of physicians for responsible opioid prescribing. And the tweet featured a photograph of a billboard and a doctor saying, come to me for your pain. And his tweet was to the effect that now today drug dealers come in white lab coats.
Let me read you an AP story. One day before lawmakers broke for the summer, Governor Andrew Cuomo and other state lawmakers announced an agreement to combat the heroin and opioid epidemic sweeping New York. It will also target prescription drug abuse. The package deal has 8 bills. Legislation would require every anti-overdose kit for heroin to have information about how to help stop an overdose and the dangers of the drug. The bills will create a statewide public awareness campaign about the dangers of opioids, increase penalties on illegal drug use and distribution, and require insurance companies to better cover substance abuse treatment. The last, of course, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, is precisely what you were talking about, the ability to get the insurance companies to pay for some of this stuff. Obviously, if both houses of the legislature and the governor get together and in a last push before the last rose of summer, they come up with this thing. They are aware that this is a terrible issue.
There is a huge awareness now. All those things that happened in the waning days of our legislative session were terrific. We needed that coverage by the insurance companies. We needed to deliver that message to the insurance companies that you have to provide inpatient care and you can't so easily reject people for it. It remains to be seen how well it will work. It will be a very big process.
Well, it'll all get transferred to the bottom line. Obviously, the people who pay for the insurance will pay more.
Right. But will the insurance companies actually follow through and provide the necessary care? It's going to be hugely expensive.
Don't get me started on that one, but because I don't think the insurance companies ought to be in the whole thing. I think we ought to be a direct payer for our health care, but that's not the way it is, and so we have to deal with what we got.
And unfortunately, we can't even have that discussion in America today.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Yeah. But the naloxone, that's a very good development. That'll save lives already. I think 25,000 doses of it have been distributed to counteract the effects of an overdose. We had a public training in Narcan, naloxone, recently. 150 parents, family members showed up to get this treatment, and they each went home with a dose of naloxone. It was the biggest training session so far in New York State. Incredible potential there to save people's lives.
Well, I think it's wonderful that the Poughkeepsie Journal, it's a Gannett paper, supports your work on this because, as you mentioned before, it's expensive. You know, you may work all year on a subject, but it's so untypical of our press today. You're a shining light, Mary Beth, in the way that it should be done. But it is not the way the press is going. Do you have any comment on that? You're married to a journalism professor. Have you talked about this?
Oh, we talk about it constantly, about the future of the press and the current state of the press. And there isn't enough solid reporting and solid journalism going on.
And it's going the wrong way.
It is because journalism and the media and newspapers are in such flux right now. The internet has, on the one hand, been a wonderful, wonderful resource for me as a reporter, both to enable my research and to get out my message. But on the other hand, it has created incredible challenges for newspapers like mine and many others, because there are just so many outlets out there for news these days, and people expect that they should get news for free.
And some good ones and some terrible ones. So let me ask you, when you worked on mental health, after the articles came a book. Will a book come from this?
Well, that remains to be seen, I guess. I do follow things for a very long period of time. And what happened with my book called Crazy in America, I had been covering New York State prisons for quite some time. And I found that there were many suicides occurring in the solitary confinement units. Long and short, one thing led to another, and the people who were committing suicide there were generally people with serious mental illness who were unmanageable in the prison population, and they were put into solitary confinement because that's all they could do with them. They didn't know how to handle them. And I covered that issue for a very long period of time from a number of different perspectives, told the tragic stories of people who had died, ultimately wrote a book about that.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, truly, we are so grateful for your coming up here and spending all of this time with us. You are a remarkable woman, and we've always known it. We've been talking to Mary Beth Pfeiffer, project writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal. Mary Beth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.